I think every time I used, it was a rock bottom, if that makes sense. I'm going to be totally truthful with you. I said, you know, you've got experience of this. It's just that absolute demoralization where you just, it's the hopelessness that got me in. You know, my first meeting was at the World's End Theatre in Chelsea.
Hmm.
It was a CA meeting. And I've got to tell you this, Paul. I heard this guy share his experience, strength and hope, and I stood up and started clapping in front of all these people, and this girl went to me, "You all right?" And I was like, oh my God. You know, I remember having a shirt on that I used to wear clubbing, you know, an old Dolce & Gabbana shirt with big holes in the elbows, you know what I mean? And my then girlfriend at the time, we went together, you know, and it's oddly enough, the guy that shared, I never forget his story. And I ended up reaching out to him about 18 months ago. He's about 30 odd years. And I was saying, oh, World's End Theatre, yeah, you know, around about 2000. He went, oh, yeah. And I went, and your story? He went, that's it. That's part of my story, yeah. He said, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So that, I think it got tattooed on my heart, what I heard.
Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefour. We are now into season 6, focusing on mental fitness in Britain's construction industry. For nearly 17 years, John the Plasterer has been living clean and sober, but his journey hasn't exactly been straightforward. It wasn't until he admitted that he was powerless over gambling that he fully embraced the life of recovery that he leads today. In this chat, John recounts a gory accident he suffered whilst intoxicated at work. He also reflects on the chaos of obsession and the richness of the life outside of addiction. John, thank you so much for coming on This Is Powerful.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
This is obviously our construction workers
mm-hmm.
series.
Yeah.
And tradesmen, of which you are one.
I am, sir, yeah.
Just want to go back to the beginning, John. Where are you from and how was your upbringing?
So my upbringing, you want to talk about my upbringing as well?
If that's
okay. So I was born in a little town called Pitsea, which satellites off of Basildon, you know, and I was born at home, you know, ex-council ass. My father was a roof tiler. My mother was the Avon lady / cleaner / you know, whatever.
Avon ladies used to make a lot of money.
They did. They did. And everyone knew my mum. I inherited a paper round from my sister, and it was all Delhi Road where I was born and the willows and the sycamores. So everybody knew me. So, you know, with the Echo, you'd get your pound and you'd keep the change, which was, I think it was 86p back in the day for 5 papers. And then, you know, so I was, you know, cha-ching.
Grafting
as a kid.
Already.
Yeah. So my upbringing, I mean, it was great because it was quite rural back then, Pitsea. So, you know, we spend hours, me and my best friend. I was born at 4 Delhi Road. He was born at 8 Delhi Road. And we both had a pup from the same litter, you know, and we'd just go birds nesting and climbing trees and, you know, catching grass snakes. And,
oh, lovely.
Oh, it was beautiful, you know. So that was, you know, so I had that element. The home life was a little bit dysfunctional with regards to my caregiver, mum, you know. She was a little bit, I think, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, if the social services, if it would have been now, we probably would have been taken away, you know, because she was quite violent, my mum. You know, she was addicted to discipline and stuff like that. But looking back now, it probably saved me from a few scrapes because I was a little bit frightened to play up and bunk school and stuff like that. So, you know, there's always a silver lining to every situation, right? Yeah. So, yeah, so, I left home when I was 16. I used to bunk school. The only time I was allowed to take time off school was when I used to go work for some plasterers. So I used to cram in the back of this old van with a cement mixer and, you know, about that much room, and off we'd go. You know, I'd leave at 5 in the morning, come home at 5 at night and get school, you know.
Is that because your mum was like, it's okay because you're earning money?
Yes, exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. So, so it was quite a volatile relationship, you know. That's pretty much where I'm at with that.
How was school?
Actually, this is good because, you know, like we talk about the disease of addiction, and it's a very self-obsessive type disease. Mm. I remember when I was at school, I remember I got put into a geography lesson with my then girlfriend, and because I was so self-obsessed, it was set two, right? I squatted and got moved up to set one. And that's the only time I ever used to apply myself, right? But other than that, I mean, my other three siblings, two of them are university graduates. The one that isn't is hyper intelligent. All three of them are really clever people. But I just didn't apply myself, in a nutshell. Mm. You know, that's the truth of it. You know, I mean, I had ability. As you probably were, I was really good at sport. I used to get AA at sport. You know, I played for the rugby team. But I think I probably struggled to focus back then. I was a bit of a daydreamer.
Yeah.
So I wasn't as disruptive as some of the really naughty kids. But, you know, more often than not, I'd get an hour's detention for playing up, you know. Yeah. And I remember once Mr. Gibbons, who was... You know, he was a good teacher. He was a PE teacher. But I don't know what... This is crazy. Yeah. When I was a kid, we was going to an away game playing rugby, and I was smoking a cigarette on the back of the bus at age 14, and he went absolutely mental.
I bet he did.
You know? So I can remember I had to go to his form class in the morning to discuss it, because he wanted to kill me. You know, he's a big, burly rugby player, this guy. And I'm sat at the back of this minibus on an away game smoking a cigarette. I mean, it's crazy, right? It was just, you know, for me, I think I watched my parents smoke. The first time I ever smoked a cigarette, well, I was 7 years of age. I used to creep downstairs, hit the ashtray, pull the dog ends out.
Do you think that was just to be like your parents, or just to see how it was?
I think so. I think it's funny because the other three kids never smoked, never.
So I had my first cigarette at seven.
Did
you? It was a Rothmans because...
Oh, my mum smoked Rothmans.
I had a tick at the corner shop.
Yeah.
So I could go in and get what I wanted because I knew my parents.
Yeah.
And part of it was showing off. So, oh yeah, I'll go in, I'll just take the Mars bar and show it to him and walk out. And then really it was because I wanted to belong with the older guys. And I was like, I can get a cigarette because they sold them in singles.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And that's how I first did it. Like, well, you have a cigarette as well.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I'm doing the cigarette thing, but
yeah.
I puff on it and blew it out and thought that is unbelievably disgusting, but carried on smoking the whole thing just to be long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think there was probably that part of the sense, you know, because it would be smoker's corner at dinner breaks, wouldn't it? You know, yeah. We'd all sit, stand there smoking. To, it was, you know, down to a, it's like
when
a
you think about it, that's nuts. Now there's no smoke anywhere. The smell of that smoke going back into a classroom.
Yeah.
How nothing was said.
Yeah, I know. I think the teachers back then just took it, as a normal thing that kids at that age was. I mean, there was kids at 12 that were regular smokers back then.
Yeah, crazy, right?
Yeah. And I think it all stemmed from the fact that we came from that generation where, you know, the adverts used to say, you know, the cowboy and Marlboro advert, right?
Yeah.
And doctors were saying it was good for you.
Mm.
So I think I inherited that sort of addiction from my parents because they both smoked.
When did you first get into drinking?
So I'd experimented with, I remember amyl nitrate when we were at school, on the school field.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, I can remember that.
Yeah.
You know, I have vivid memories of the amyl nitrate. You look like you've been to Magaloo for two weeks, didn't you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was that. But I didn't really, I think when I may have had a spliff when I was 14, but I landed running when I left school and I had a decent amount of money in my pocket. You know, I can remember 87 when I first took a yellow Cali.
Yeah.
And I remember that I was in a nightclub because I lived and died in Ministry of Sound for a number of years.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I'd done the 1999 Millennium Party. It was just 48 hours. It was just, you can imagine, can't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A friend of mine used to work there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, don't ask me who the resident DJ was, because all I wanted to do was go in there, get on a speaker and get absolutely mangled, you know. Yeah.
I remember some people used to stand in the speakers in that place as well.
Yeah. I remember... At another nightclub one night, I fell asleep in front of the speaker and how can you fall asleep in front of a 10K speaker? But I did it because I was just so mangled, and then I got dragged out by the bouncers and that, yeah. So, but yeah.
So did you, when you first had a drink or took something, did you feel like, oh, I found something here, this?
Well, I just remember, so when I, like I say, when I left school, funny enough, you talk about older boys and being impressionable, there was guys that were slightly older than me, and they started selling puff and stuff like that. You know, and I'd sort of go and buy an eighth or whatever, and that's where my sort of journey started, was probably, I can remember, I don't know if you remember, Paul, when you used to get the real giggles, you know, you used to have a joint and you'd
don't remember anything.
Yeah, you know, but you know, so there was that honeymoon period with it, and we'd all knock around down the market stalls and all, you know, you know, if I was, my war cry really when I talk about my story is that, you know, I drank weak lager and smoked my own body weight in puff from a very early age,
yeah,
you know. So, and then obviously that progressed into speed and trips and then lots of ecstasy. You know, I became obsessed with ecstasy. I remember getting a, you know, the Face magazine.
Yeah.
That
was my first photo.
Was it?
My first job.
Really? Yeah. Wow. The Face magazine.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Is it still going, the Face magazine? It's not, right?
Shut down years ago.
Did it?
That was my, yeah, that was brilliant.
Oh, wow.
I remember doing a shoot with a guy called Mark Le Bon.
Mark Le Bon, right.
Yeah.
No connection with Simon?
No.
Right. So, yeah, so this guy, I think I got, you know, talking to him in a smoky kitchen one night after the club, and he said, oh, there's a, if you go, this is a backdated one that you can get, and it was called The Agony and the Ecstasy, and it was all about ecstasy, where it came from, that kind of thing. Because I don't know that, it's only with hindsight, right? When you're in a nightclub and you've got the confidence to walk up to a beautiful woman and, you know, and you exchange numbers and all that stuff, I won't go into detail, but, you know, and it gives you, and again, it's only through standing at this point in my life, I didn't know that I was doing that stuff to fit in, you know, I think... I had arrived, as it says in the book, you know, it says that, doesn't it? And I think that's what it was, you know. Took me out of the mundane, this self-obsession, you know, momentarily. And I had some really good times, you know.
I like the way you said honeymoon period.
The honeymoon period.
Yeah, it's true.
There's a little honeymoon period with it all, isn't there? Because it's, you know, it's progressive, isn't it, I guess? You know, but, you know, I had a major accident on a building site as a result of my using. I was trapped in a scree pump on a building site for 2.5 hours.
How old was you then?
17. I was 17.
So young, so still like...
Yeah, 17 years of age, and I'd been, you know, drinking weak lager and smoking my own body weight in puff as per usual, and I slipped, but I didn't really. That's what I said to the solicitor. And luckily enough, the machine was, it was winding down, but I turned it off, so luckily it was winding down. And I ended up with that big scar.
That looks nasty.
Trapped in the machine for 2.5 hours. Yeah. They were going to amputate at the scene. I lost 3 pints of blood.
That's on John's hand, by the way, for those who are listening, not watching.
You can see that. Yeah. I don't know if anyone can see it. But yeah, I broke 5 bones. I dislocated my wrist. I had a bone pop out of the palm of my hand. They were going to amputate. Yeah. Luckily enough, I mean, I've got newspaper clippings of it.
When using it for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
How was that? Because was you stoned or?
So I was compos mentis, but I think, I'm assuming that they were using ketamine too, because the doctors were there as well. So there was, you know, there was a fleet of ambulances, there was doctors that were brought to site. You know, I lost a lot of blood when I was trapped in there because I had an open wound, and the guy that I worked for, because, you know, he fainted, and he, you know, it probably scarred him for life. So my addiction really...
affected others.
Perfect, yeah. You've nailed it.
Yeah.
My addiction affected others. And it happened in St Albans, so I ended up in St Albans Hospital.
Yeah.
And I was walking down the corridor, you know, going to have a cigarette, oddly enough, and this doctor went to me, oh, you're a bit of a celebrity. And I went, and he showed me this newspaper cutting. So I've got all the newspaper cuttings. Yeah. Mums keep things like that, don't they? So, and there's a photo of me leaning across the machine like that. And I just remember, like, now and again, I'd come back to consciousness because I was obviously being knocked out, and then I could just hear the drone of the fire engines, because they ended up using Oxyacetylene burners to cut me out.
Wow. Wow.
So luckily enough, you know, because I'm left-handed.
Yeah. So you're lucky you got your hand.
I've had a whole career out of that, right?
Yeah.
You know, what could possibly go wrong? An addict and dangerous machinery.
Exactly. It
was always going to go one way, right?
So have you always done roofing?
Plastering. Always done plastering since the very early. I was a plasterer's labourer.
When you said the tiles, for some reason I was thinking of roofing.
I'm a plasterer by trade, yeah. Plastering and rendering, that's all I've done.
Yeah.
That's what I went on to do, and I ended up with a decent size. I've mentioned you about that. I went from on the tools to being a co-director.
How was that if you was smoking your own body weight? How did you get from being on the tools to directing your own company?
So I sort of, at the time, the guy that I went into partnership with wanted to leave the fellow that we were working for, and we sort of calibrated, you know, and I think I'd moved on to you know, that my end game was cocaine and alcohol and prescribed drugs, you know, and so the guy that I sort of formed the partnership with, we sort of calibrated. But in the years from when it started, when the company was formed, to sort of run its course over 5, maybe 10, I can't remember, it accelerated my disease, you know, my using.
Were you doing commercial properties or houses?
Lots of commercial properties for big main contractors, yeah. We had, you know...
So big work.
Yeah, big jobs. You know, one job that I did in recent years, I think the contract was probably worth, you know... I don't like... It sounds a little bit egotistical.
No, but
yeah, it's a true story, right? Yeah. So we went from scratch, 2 plasterers on the tools, formed a limited company. I remember our first invoice we put in was for about £1,500, and then we ended up, you know, doing all these big contracts.
Yeah.
I think we turned over, I mean, it's a long time ago. I think we ended up turning over 2.9 million was our best year, with a lot of profit.
Yeah.
So
yeah, so big contracts.
Yeah, some big contracts, you know. We'd take on domestic work as well, but it was generally big contracts, you know, all around London and places like that, you know. So I had an opportunity to hide, because he was office-based.
Yeah.
And I was a contracts manager, you know. I wasn't on the tools. I became a contracts manager within my company.
So you was flying around basically seeing other people do their stuff.
Yeah, and that's it, you know, sitting in contractual meetings and stuff like that. You know, but I can pull over in the lay-by, can't I, have a big blast or whatever, and then go about my business.
When you formed this partnership,
mm-hmm.
what kind of level was you at using then, and how and why do you think that progressed?
I just think it took a natural course. It sort of flowed into me using pretty much daily, because I was and this is not everyone's experience, because I know a lot of addicts, but my experience is I'd run for 3 days with no sleep using, and then I'd swear off because I'd been, you know,
that was my process.
Was it right?
I was not someone who used something daily.
There
was a part of me after the honeymoon period, after I kind of realized, hang on a minute, I'm using a lot more than I thought. Like, this was fun once a week on a weekend for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got down to like a 3-day process, what I called it, which mm-hmm. was like, you know, getting hammered for 3 days. Then I'd literally have a day just around the house eating rubbish food and that. And then I'd go and have a sunbed, go to the gym, have a steam, maybe get a haircut or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Buy a new outfit so I look fine. And then feel like, right, this is it. I'm done. This is it. I'm done.
Got you.
And then just fancy coming out. Well, I'll come out for a little bit and then back on again. Same thing.
We're cut from the same cloth, mate. Honestly, that's exactly, you know, that's pretty much my story. You know, I'd swear off. You know, I was never going to do it again. I know it's a bit of a recovery fridge magnet, but I'd swear off and say I was never going to do it again. And I could have probably gone on a lie detector and it would come up that I'm telling the truth, because I was convinced. But then the obsession had kicked in. And, you know, like you, once I'd had my hair cut and I felt better again, gone to the gym, and I'd be back at it.
This is important, though, for people who are listening and may not be in recovery yet, is that you know, when you've come off of a bender or whatever session you're on, that you always feel like, oh, I've got this anyway. I've got control over this. I will stop.
Yeah.
Maybe not ready yet, but I'm definitely going to stop.
Absolutely.
At that point, that conversation usually means you're way past the point of stopping.
Absolutely.
Because it's easy to say you can do something until you try it. And then when you try it, it's a different ballgame.
I think so. And I think with regards to addiction, because I know some people that are heroin addicts that's, you know, I've got some good friends that are heroin addicts that are, you know, stealing out of shops and going to prison, stuff like that. And they didn't have that, you know, swearing off period where they get a day clean. But you're thinking, is that the same? And my, it's going to kill us anyway. It's still going to kill me. It's still going to kill me, you know. You know, and I know people that use, like you and I, that in recent years have died of this, you know, same substance, same behaviour, same patterns, drop down dead of heart attacks, you know, while they're using, you know. So
In that period when...
Sneaky though, Paul, isn't it? The way it does, like, oh yeah, I'll be fine. I'm good now. Sorry to
interrupt. Yeah, it's insidious, isn't it?
It's insidious, mate. Yeah.
I always think it's a war between your consciousness and an unconscious process.
Yeah.
You know? In that period, before you was getting like the really, really big jobs, did your business partner say anything or know anything, or did you think you had a problem?
Well, he's a big drinker. So, and when we, so the time we formed the company, a lot of the guys were in there. Oh, you can you imagine what it was like, chaos, right? Got all these lads in their early 20s, right? You know.
Doing financially well as well.
Yeah, because, you know, we was all earning good money. You know, it was booming back then, you know. But most of us were using, you know, towards the latter part of my using, I'd got my dealer, I'd got him a job working for me as a mastic man. So I used to be using all through the night, and then I'd be driving the van to, I think we was in Wandsworth, Smugglers Way, Riverside West Project, all the way down there. We worked for a company called St. George's. And I got, like I say, I got him a job, and he'd come in the morning, sit in the seat, and he'd be going, and I'd be like, you know.
Yeah.
So, but all of us were using, really.
Well, you definitely kept it close to home then, didn't you?
Yeah, you know. So,
did it start, because you were doing the same thing, it kind of...
I hid amongst it, didn't I?
Yeah, but it probably doesn't seem bad because you're all at it and stuff.
Yeah.
But as a sober man now, what's been your experience on site? Do you still see people using stuff?
Not as much. It's not as prolific as it was back in the day, you know, and I don't, I sort of tend to... I can spot an addict a mile off, you know. I can't sort of say you're an addict. Obviously, it's self-diagnosis, but, you know, there's been, it's funny because you can generally tell an addict, not by how much they use, but people generally treading on eggshells when they're, you know, in their company, you know. But I've reached out to people on building sites and got the odd person to a meeting based on their using.
Is that you approaching them or them actually approaching you? Because now you're sober and you can see, obviously, you're straight going.
Yeah, there's been a couple of occasions, but I think you sort of become a lighthouse in a way without being grandiose. You know, you sort of become, you know, I've got a very good friend who's, oddly enough, he celebrates the same clean time as me, 5th of the 12th. But he's 5 years. I'm 16, coming on for 17. But he was 10. He's 10 years younger than me. He was my labourer, and he was, you know, real hard hitting, crack addict. And he's 5 years now. And I think the reason why he's in recovery, because he was in and out. I think maybe for 15 years he was bouncing in and out of the rooms, but now he's got it going on. Do you know what I mean? And I think that was a result of maybe me Googling cocaine addiction all them years ago, then getting the clean time, and then he see what was going on for me. He knew how I used, and I think that was an example for him to then apply himself to the 12th, the recovery program.
So how did it start to fall apart for you?
I think every time I used, it was a rock bottom, if that makes sense. I'm going to be totally truthful with you. I said, you know, you've got experience of this. It's just that absolute demoralisation where you just, it's the hopelessness that got me in, you know. My first meeting was at the World's End Theatre in Chelsea.
Hmm.
It was a CA meeting. And I've got to tell you this, Paul. I heard this guy share his experience, strength and hope, and I stood up and started clapping in front of all these people, and this girl went to me, "You all right?" And I was like, oh, my God. You know, I remember having a shirt on that I used to wear clubbing, you know, an old Dolce & Gabbana shirt with big holes in the elbows, you know what I mean? And, yeah, my then girlfriend at the time, we went together, you know. And it's oddly enough, the guy that shared, I never forget his story. And I ended up reaching out to him about 18 months ago. He's about 30-odd years.
Oh, wow.
You might even know, but, yeah, so, and I was saying, oh, World's End Theatre, yeah, you know, around about 2000. He went, oh, yeah. And I went, and your story? He went, that's it. That's part of my story, yeah. He said, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So that, I think it got tattooed on my heart, what I heard.
Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you. And to say, if you've heard something on the show that's moved you, please follow, rate, or review the show, and it'd be amazing if you could share it. Now back to the show. When you say hopelessness, for those that don't understand what that means, what does that look like?
It's when everything drifts away, and you're on your own, and you don't want to use anymore, but you keep on using. You're in absolute psychosis, and your life becomes small. You know, at the time, my business partner bought a 4-bedroom house with a swimming pool, and I was stuck in a little 1-bedroom flat.
Mm.
You know, in arrears with the rent. The electricity bill broke in with the council and put a smart meter on because I didn't think I needed to pay electricity. Not that I had the money to.
Mm.
Thousands of pounds in debt, no relationship with my family, you know, my girlfriend, I broke her heart 1,000 times, a girl that I was with at the time, and I'm not a silly man, I'm quite a smart guy, like, you know, most addicts are, but I just knew that this way of living was just futile.
Hmm.
So I wanted to change, you know. I think there was something in me that there was a little bit of willingness, you know. And it's funny because my friend that Greg is 5 years. He said, with us, you only get very small windows of opportunity where you might get to a meeting or you might reach out and tell someone, because then, like we said, the obsession's back on you. And I just think, you know, I managed to somehow, because I used to get on my knees when I'd go 3-4 days using, and it's like, it's just destructive, it's awful, isn't it? And then I used to get on my knees and pray. I know it sounds a bit, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say that, you know, because it was so, awful. It's very hard to articulate, isn't it, addiction?
Did you have a moment? Yeah, it is. It can be. It's because it's a very personal thing, even though there's certain symptoms that are the same.
Yeah.
Did you ever look at your partner at the time when he was buying that house thinking, why haven't I got that? How come he's got more money than me? How does that work?
I did. Yeah, I had all that. You know, you start getting all these little alarm, well, they're alarm bells, aren't they?
Yeah, signs of what's going on.
I'm getting a director's salary.
Mm.
I mean, back then, you know, the economy was booming, wasn't it? You know, I was getting all my expenses paid, going on holidays, you know, and, you know, well, if I didn't miss the flights to go, you know, because I was drunk or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I see him and people that were my age, you know, that were coupling up, that were getting married and this kind of thing. And you know, don't you, intuitively know that what you're doing is not serving you, but you've got no way out because you've got no solution, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did you ever talk to anyone on site or anything like that, or did you keep it yourself? Because part of this whole thing is that we're talking about men on building sites, because it is not the usual place that you open up and talk.
I didn't really discuss it as such. Oh, I tried a bit of therapy. So my my girlfriend at the time, her aunt was a therapist, and we'd arranged to go there on the Saturday morning. She said, do me a favour, do not use. I went, of course I won't. I'm driving to Bedford, wherever it was, to meet her aunt. We need to go in the petrol station. I'm sniffing coke and I'm getting back in the car. I'm sat opposite her in her little, therapy room.
Did you actually go there for therapy?
I went there for therapy to discuss my addiction.
That must have been difficult because it'd have been hard to talk, wouldn't it? Because if you're your girlfriend's, aren't
you? Yeah. But I mean, she, I did open up. I told her the truth. I was quite truthful actually. Wow. That was that's oddly enough. Yeah, I actually opened up and told her how much I was spending and what was going on, how often I was using. So I did.
I think really asking for help then?
I was. Yeah. I was asking for help. Yeah. I think that was my first sort of active attempt, maybe, at finding a way out. Because I wanted out. There was definitely something in me that was driving me for a new way of life. I didn't know that at the time because it's not so obvious, is it? But
yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? It's a weird thing to describe because it's not, as a sober thinking person with straight thinking, you can think, okay, this is not working, so I'm going to go and try something else. But in that situation, it's more like, I just need to change. I don't want to feel like this anymore. I don't want to think like this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else seems to be doing better than me, but I can't work it out because I think I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
Or whatever the narrative is.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think I. It's funny. I lost my sister in 2024, and when she was in the hospital, she said to me, "We really didn't know what to do with you. We were gonna. I think my elder brother Peter, who's 6'3", he's a ex-rugby player, he's a power greater than myself, he used to go to me, what are you doing? I think they were going to try and intervene and get me into a treatment centre, but I just don't think I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't admit that I was that bad. I wouldn't go to the doctors because I didn't want it to go on record that I had problems with addiction.
That's an important thing to say, actually, because I did the same. And a lot of people won't do that because they don't want it to go on record, which is really bad.
See, I didn't want to, I had this, I guess it's connected with what I was seeing going on with me and people blooming and getting houses and stuff like that. I was like, well, and this is a true story, if I go on record as being an addict, what if the mortgage company finds out? Not that I was anywhere near being capable. It weren't within my... it was never going to happen the way I was carrying on, the money that I was spending, and because it was just ammunition for my disease, really. Spending. I spent thousands, and I bet my first ever meeting was a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in 1991. That was my first ever. I was 21 years of age.
Wow, that was early.
Yeah, so I went to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting. But I mean, obviously, I went another 10 years and the substances were more prolific than the gambling, but I've only just put that down. 8 years ago, I put the gambling down. Horrific, Paul, horrific. And a lot of people on building sites gamble. I know that from experience.
That's interesting.
A lot of people on sites.
On what kind of gambling?
I was nags and mutts.
Do you want to explain what it is for our international?
Okay. Nag is a horse, isn't it? And a mutt is a dog, right?
Yeah.
Funny enough, on the way in, I see Romford...
Dog track,
but I used to live and die in the bookmakers. I've got experience from when, I got a rebate, through working on the building sites. I think it was 1,200 quid. I'm going back a lot of years, I was probably 18, 19. I can remember just going in that bookmakers and spending it, 1,200 quid, 9,000, 7, 1,500, 300. I remember being in the bookmakers where I was, and it was shame, I felt ashamed, I remember being in that particular time when I had that money when I was a kid, and I remember the girl behind the ramp, she went, you got a bet behind the ear worth 300 quid. I said, have I? She went, you got a dog try cast up. She went, don't you tell the bookmaker. So I used to bet, it was just all chaos the way I used to gamble, do you know what I mean? And I didn't even know I had a winning slip behind there, So, but yeah, it was mainly dogs and horses that I used to gamble on, you know. I was never...
And did that take up your mental space on site? Like, were you watching what it was doing?
Yeah, yeah. You can't function, you know. You're always preoccupied about, you know, the bet or you know, or getting to the bookmakers. And I can remember once driving back from Wanstead, that contract that I was... And I remember being... I'd been on it for days on end, and I remember driving along, you know, you could have tucked my eyes in my socks, you know what I mean? I was like that. And I remember being on the A13, I thought, I'll have a bet when I get back. And all of a sudden, I got all this energy back, and I'm alive. Because it just must shoot all this endorphin, all these chemicals just lights your body up as an addict, doesn't it? Bing, I'm brand new. So I think, you know, we've got this chemical reaction. I'm not a doctor, you know, I'm not
a... No, there's a complete chemistry set inside that does it, but it shows you the power of, like, addiction. It only takes a thought to completely change the way you feel.
Yeah, lovely, well presented.
Incredible.
Yeah. I'll never forget it, Paul.
Yeah,
boing, I'm back, because I know I've got money in my pocket. And my gambling was very similar to my using, you know. I used to be embarrassed, because I used to go to the ramp, I'd be losing all this money, and I'd have to go to another bookmaker's because I was so full of shame, you know, spending thousands and thousands and not getting a draw, you know.
That's painful, isn't it?
Oh.
That's painful.
You know, I'm sure there's people that are going to identify with this, that are going to listen to this podcast, but I'd finish a job, you know, plastering job, I might have been there for 3 weeks, and the customer said, you know, there's the money, and I might have $3,000 or $4,000 in my back pocket. I think, I'll have one bet, I'll have a tenner, and I'd come out, you know, a day, you know, like, I'd be in there all day.
Yeah.
Come out with no money, just to chew up bookmaker's pen.
It's hard to explain the powerlessness of that.
Oh,
that you intend to go in for one 10 bet. I've never bet in my life, right? Because my granddad...
Yes.
...bet houses away.
Did he?
He went,
bless him.
He'd done very well, but he didn't do very well in the end.
Yeah.
Because he bet most of it away. And even, and I love my granddad, so it's all good in that, not to speak bad of him. But he'd been to bookmakers every day, just doing little bets in the end all the way along.
Yeah.
And I think that's why my dad never bet either. And I think because we saw that,
mm-hmm.
I didn't see it as a romantic thing, as a cool thing. I saw it as the opposite.
Got you.
And I think that was very fortunate for me. Very fortunate
that you see your granddad.
Yeah, because I would have, I would say things, so in the sporting way, I'd bet a friend, I bet I can do this, or I bet you could do that. And from winning, whether it be a race or a drive or whatever, the challenge and the endorphins I would get was so strong that I know that if I started to bet in a shop, I'd be in real trouble.
Yeah, so you've kept you out of that scrape.
Never done it. Even when people have said, oh, do you want to bet on this whatever race? And I'll be like, no, I'm all right. Because I knew I'd feared not having control.
I mean, as far as I'm aware, it is the disease of addiction. And if you're an addict, you're an addict, you know. But as far as I'm aware, they've got a real high mortality rate, haven't they, gamblers?
Huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. I mean, when I first went to Vegas, I couldn't believe it. I saw some of these old ladies who looked like they was out of a movie with like the big purpley grey hair sitting there on potty seats.
What?
Because they wouldn't leave the machines.
And
they have these potty seats. They can go to the toilet on there. And I'm talking like 70-year-old ladies.
Oh my goodness.
Horrified from that.
That is, I've never known. Yeah. I didn't know that. Never went to Vegas. I thought about going and putting everything on black.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, that was the obsession.
I had a friend of mine, I won't mention his name because he's not in recovery, but he, when I lived in LA, he was a gambler, and he was a really, really lovely human being.
Mm-hmm.
But the way he calculated stuff, and it makes sense totally now, because he had money, he was a working actor and that, but
mm-hmm.
we'd go down to a street called Melrose, which is where, like, kind of like Camden, like secondhand T-shirts, pre-worn stuff.
Got ya.
And he'd be like, I'm going to go down there, I'm going to swap some T-shirts and do this. And I just thought he was trendy, but I realised he had no money.
Right.
Because he was just gambling all the way.
Got ya.
Made total sense after I'd left. I was like, oh, yeah.
Right, so he was earning good money as well as an actor,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, completely.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. It destroys people, doesn't it?
Yeah, incredible.
It destroys people, you know.
How did you get out of that? Because that's such a powerful thing.
How did I get out of that? So I had a bit of a... Because before, prior to being... I'm 16 and a half years clean. I know you're well over that, aren't you?
I'm about 22.
Lovely. Look at that. Beautiful. Yeah. So I had 5.5 years prior to that, and I think I had 13 months prior to that. But I'd gone... So the early part of this 16 years, I sort of... There was occasions where I could go 2 years without gambling, right?
Yeah.
And then about 8 years ago, which is roughly how long I've not been gambling, I'd hit a rock bottom within my recovery.
Yeah.
But I'd had a bit of a Gobi Desert period with meetings, oddly enough, and I was gambling. And I come back to the rooms, and I've been embedded in the rooms for the last 8 years, very regular meetings, lots of sponsoring and that kind of thing and other stuff. And I had a chat with a woman in the tea room at a meeting who's 30 years now. Beautiful lady called Pat, and I said to her, you know, I can't stop gambling. She said, well, listen, she said to me, when you're stood in that bookmaker's gambling, she said, you're not growing spiritually. Boom. And I thought, I just needed someone to say something, and it was that lady who said it, right? And pretty much from that day on, I've not gambled, because I just knew that I needed to grow spiritually. If I didn't, because I was in my disease, wasn't I? My disease, as you know, is all whack-a-mole gear, right? It was just manifesting in that area. And I had to just surrender to it, you know, because
Go on,
mate.
No, as I say, it's amazing that one person can say one sentence and you hear it.
Yep.
And that can change everything.
You know, like, you think, I was like, hang on a minute. Yeah, I'm not growing spiritually. I need to... You know, within the last 8 years, I've been through the process again with the work. You know, I'm just on another one, actually. I just started another step one, and it's total abstinence, Paul, as well.
Mm.
You know, I used to go fishing on a boat once a month with all the 8 guys, and there was 2 crew, the skipper and a mate, and it'd be a tenner in heaviest fish, you know, so you can imagine it were all competitive. Yeah, I've got one. But And even then, I stopped even putting into that. They were like, why aren't you putting in? I'm like, because I'm just not, you know. Mm. So it's total abstinence, you know. And don't get me wrong, when you see these big adverts on the telly, buy a ticket and win this house in Windermere for 10 million. That sort of tends to, like, I can be like a moth to a flame with that stuff. But, it's total abstinence.
And is that's a no-no either?
Anything like that.
No lottery tickets.
Yeah. The whole thing.
And
scratch
for people,
cards and nothing, you know.
Yeah.
I might paper, scissors, rock with someone, see who pays for a meal now and again.
You might be safe with that.
Yeah.
But in saying that, you're right though, because total abstinence for people is literally like you can't go near anything, right? Because it's kind of like feeding the beast, isn't it? If you dabble a little bit, you might awaken up that beast.
Definitely. Yeah, and I tell you, when I'm not in the middle of the bed with this stuff, all of a sudden I notice a Ladbrokes when I'm driving past.
Mm.
Yeah, look, you know, that fluorescent red writing, all of a sudden I can see it again. But I just seem to, you know, when I do this stuff, I just seem to be, there's an immunity almost, isn't there? Like, you don't notice, you know.
I didn't go
past Romford Dog Track. Was on the right and think, oh, do you know what? I'll think on the way back, I'm going to nip me in and have a couple of £100.
I'll pull the train over.
Yeah, that's it. Pull the emergency call. That's it. Jump out, you know. Number 6. I was all numbers as well. 1, 2, 3. 2, 1, 3. Tricast. 1, 2, reverse foot. It was all...
That's what my friend
was
doing. Rain
Man type stuff.
That's what my friend was doing.
Yeah.
Everything was numbers. And the way he used to talk was
numbers.
All about numbers. And
yep.
It's interesting because... you know, you said, so that's a frequent thing on sites still, is it, for people to gamble?
I've known a lot of people that have, that have gambling addictions.
Yeah. It's difficult, isn't it? Because you've got all these, like even on my phone, the adverts that come up on social media for betting. I mean, you can bet now from wherever you are, in the toilet if you want to.
Yeah.
Which must be really difficult.
Oh, you can go all the way through the night can't you? Gambling. You know, you can spend thousands, can't you?
Yeah.
And I know that they, the amount that they lay out these big companies, I mean, the CEO of Paddy Power, one of them, paid themselves a £50 million dividend or something. There's good money in it, isn't there? There's lots of money in it.
Well, yeah, more than good money. I mean, it's basically, it's just a one-way street, really.
It is. There's no winning. You know, there's no, I know someone who was a, who looked after big spenders, you know, worked for Sporting Index, and, you know, some of these personalities that know their onions, with that are ex-sportsmen and women, you know, they'd win, you know, 50K, but then the next week they'd do 50K and another 50K back. Mm. There's no, you know, there's, you can't win money at the horses.
Would you describe that to people in the sense of, logically, you're smart and you know that. How does one put a bet on when you know more likely you're not going to win anyway?
I just think it's like you mentioned, that internal chemistry set, right? It's too much of a draw for me not to, you know, it's, I just think that even that losing outweighs, yeah, I just think, I don't know, I just think it's too much, it's too powerful for me.
Mm.
I've got no power with it, you know, I've got no power, I cannot resist it, you know, and with me, you know, I'd stand in there and do $3,000 or $4,000 and it'd be absolute carnage and like the shame of it all, and then I'd recover from it like I would the using.
Yeah. How, what was
it? You know, when you're back again, right? You got, you said you got your hair cut, you got your trainers and you're back in the gym.
Mm.
And you're back, and you almost forget the suffering and the pain and the misery from like a week ago, didn't you? You sort of know, but you still just can't resist. This the temptation is too powerful, right? That's,
yeah. When you got sober,
mm-hmm,
and you was gambling, did that feel toxic? Because you're,
yes,
kind of on a spiritual path,
yes,
doing really good sobriety, yes, and then you're doing that.
Absolutely did. Yeah, I knew deep down, I knew that what I was doing wasn't, it was congruent with what I've been shown.
Mm.
You know, I actually had a period within this last 16 years, I think it was sort of, I was 5 years clean maybe, where I went through the work just for the addiction, the gambling. You know, that was specifically with the sponsor that I was with. We went through the work just for the gambling to try and see if we could sort of, you know, get something, you know, to try and pry me away from it.
Mm.
You know, so I knew that it wasn't a good idea. I knew it wasn't good for me, and that it wasn't along the lines of, you know, working that spiritual path. And so, yeah.
After you put the gambling down, how long was it before you felt free of that?
I think once I'd surrendered and decided, made the decision to, you know, once I had that little conversation with Pat in the tea room,
So when did you, after you put the gambling down and made that decision,
yeah,
when did you feel like, I'm not a gambler anymore, I'm liberated, I feel...
I think it's almost, it's pretty much instant. Do you know what I mean? I know it sounds a little bit egotistical, but the money that I'd saved up, I know this is just it's one of them to this disease, right? I saved up $33,000, walked into a showroom, bought myself a Porsche Panamera GTI, right?
Brilliant.
Yeah. You know, and I know it sounds a little bit like, oh, that's all the... I know people go, oh, well, that's the low-hanging fruit. Well, for me, it's not.
Not if you've been gambling all the time and you finally had the ability to save.
18 months later, I'd say $33,000, walked into a showroom, bought a beautiful Porsche, you know, and that is that. I'm like, wow, this is what... Because money's important. I know people sort of... And I get emotional, mental and spiritual stuff is... But that... is just a beautiful byproduct.
No, I did the same. Well, I bought a, I rewarded myself by buying a motorbike I've always wanted, because for me,
good.
I could have spent that on booze or drugs or hotel rooms or whatever else it was.
Mm.
And that for me was, I paid for that. Yeah. I earned that. It was a clean, I was going to say a clean win. That would have been a bad pun, but like a clean win. It was. That's what I've saved up for. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, it's liberating for me. This is a it's a reward in that sense.
Yeah, and I think that's important, yeah, right?
It's different from buying something to show other people. It's like, what do you want?
It was for me. I went in there, you know, paid for it in one go, you know, and, you know, it wasn't nothing, you know, it's a lovely car, you know, and, you know, am I proud of myself that I did it? No, I'm very thankful and grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, that's just a byproduct, isn't it, of me surrendering to something, and then this happens. Oh wow!
Yeah.
You know, like all the travelling I've been doing, I've got money now. I've been to Japan. I went to Japan last year. Beautiful backpacking holiday with my nephews and all that kind of stuff. That you get the opportunity to live, because it's not living, is it? It's not living. It's just grim, man. You know, going to work on a building site, all weathers, knocking your pan out. People work hard. Most people, you know, work really hard. Bricklayers, plasterers, renderers, you know, whatever, electricians. And if you've got this stuff going on, it's so demoralising, isn't it? Because you don't get an opportunity to go to nice countries and
You guys, you know, earn a lot of money doing a good job. It's all a skill.
Yep.
Takes a long time to master something and to be consistently good at something. Because everyone can say they can do it, but when you try something.
Yeah.
It's different. So, yeah, it's living, isn't it? Going to Japan and...
Yeah. And doing what you know... I think it's our birthright to be happy, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I probably wouldn't say that on a building site. All right, lads, it's your birthright to be happy, you know, because I wouldn't, you know.
Do you still feel like on a building site that you can't speak freely in ways like that? Because in recovery, obviously, people are quite spiritual. They talk about good things and liberation and happiness and gratefulness. Yeah. And
I have to be slightly guarded, you know, because you can set yourself up for... You don't want to lead in the ring with... leading the prize ring with a chin?
Yeah.
You know, because I tell you what this program's given me as well, and it probably would help people that are in the building game. I let people come to me. I can feel them out. Do you know what I mean? You know, I can tell if a site agent's going to be, you know, flexible or he's going to be awkward. I just get a real lovely feel. You get a feel for people, don't you?
Yeah, you're conscious and you can read people, can't you?
So, you know, that's a big one, it's nice not gambling, it's nice not using, but getting that gift. And I'm not, it doesn't make me any better than anyone else. It just makes me a little bit more in tune, right? And I can sort of, I don't set myself up for disappointment quite as much. With that tool, you know, that I've been given, and it's not a tool that it's only on a daily basis that I get to use that. Do you know what I mean? So, I sort of, you know, there are people that I can get a feel for on building sites where I can open up a bit more. You know, you always get someone that you get drawn to people, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, and I split up with my business partner about 2010. And it wasn't quite amicable. I got sort of bought out, which was nice, you know. But we are still good friends now. And if he gets any work coming, he goes, "Oh, do you want to do that?" Because there's some specialised stuff that not many other people could do, and I do it. And he's like, "I've got a job," and I'm like, "Yeah, no problem, mate." So that's nice, right?
It's nice that he trusts you, and you know that you're going to turn up.
And I don't mind working for him.
Yeah,
if I can nick a few quid, then that's all right.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't got that type of pride attached to it, you know.
Have you noticed anything on sites where there's like a helpline, or is there anything when you go on a big site that, like, if anyone's got any issues, they can go and source help from?
I think there's a few main contractors that are doing that now. I'm not sure, but I know that there's NA have been doing adverts in shop windows and stuff, and also at cash points, the NA, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know how current. I don't know if it's still current, but yeah, because I'm a GSR for my home group,
right.
So I go to the business meeting once a month, and all this stuff gets discussed. That's really grown up being a GSR. I used to be a tea maker. you know what I mean? And yeah, I do a little announcement once a month about what's going on in the area. It's quite funny because I don't like the business stuff. I like to render. I like to, you know, I like to plaster that wall and go home. I don't like to do, you know, drawing. You know, I'm more, people have got different skill sets, I guess, haven't they? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, everyone's different.
Everyone's different. So, but going to that meeting, you know, but I do it because it's worth doing. It's worth to, you know, but yeah. So I think with stuff like that, I think there are, I think some of the, like NAR reaching out in different areas, but I'm not 100%.
But is there contractors and companies you think that are helping people, or is that still a taboo?
I'm not 100% sure, if I'm honest.
Yeah,
I'm not 100% sure. I've never seen it on a big main contractor site where they're... It gets mentioned, if you go to a site and it's a big RDAP site, when you get inducted, there'll be, you know, that'll be discussed, drug use and stuff like that. You know, it will get highlighted. Yeah. You know, and I'm sure if you went to a site manager and you explained what was going on for you, they'd probably put you in contact with someone, wouldn't they, I guess?
Last question, John. What would you say
to... We could have done 3 hours, couldn't we, really? But I know, it's...
Always, it goes very quickly.
Yeah.
What would you say to people listening that if they have a problem in this business or they have a problem in general, what they should do?
I think get honest. You know, get honest, you know, reach out. You know, there's so much, you know, NAA, CA and GA haven't got the monopoly on recovery. You know, there's so many different outlets that you can go to. Just try it out. You know, if it's troublesome for you and it's causing, even if you think you're on the way to that, you know, you can jump off at any stage. But, you know, talk about it because, you know, like we said, you know, the mortality rates are horrific with gamblers, but they are with all addicts, you know. Tell your partner, get honest, you know, and reach out to someone, get professional help. Yeah, that's probably cool. That's probably what I'd suggest.
John, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
This is Powerful. Is brought to you by Stride Foundation UK, which educates the public about addiction, recovery, and the wealth of surrounding issues. We use lived experience and evidence-based science to support those in recovery and those struggling with addiction. To find out more about what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate. Please donate. It really, really helps us to put this on for you guys. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will also help us to educate more of the population, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.